Welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast, featuring interviews with incredible working artists who are also mothers and compelling conversations regarding parenting and the art world. These conversations create a space for inclusivity and support for artist mothers worldwide. I'm Kaylin Butine, painter, mom of three, and podcast host. I'm so grateful you are tuning in, and I hope you enjoy this episode.
Feminism gets a really bad rap because of multiple reasons, but especially because it's always been tied to the binary, the idea of the binary, right? Of the binary gender. And so I think, for me, future feminism, it's inclusive, it's intergenerational, it leads environmental justice initiatives, it follows Black, Latinx, Native American, queer, all the kind of minorities, and it comes from this place of pursuing bodily autonomy. It also is based in the politics of belonging. So having a space and really just centering the lives of the most vulnerable among us.
Friends, I am so excited to welcome Liz LaFleur to the Artist Mother Podcast today. Liz is an American artist, educator, and activist. Through her disciplinary arts-based research, production, and experimentation, she explores queer identity and the future of feminism. Liz has exhibited, screened, and lectured internationally, including at the Tate London, the Reykjavik Art Museum in Iceland, the South by Southwest Museum in Austin, Texas, the Museum of Glass in Seattle, Washington, among others. She is the recipient of a Citizen Artist Fellowship with the John F. Kennedy Center, an immersive scholar grant from the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation, and earned her MFA as a Media Art Fellow at Emerson College in Boston, Massachusetts. Liz is an associate professor of new media art at the University of North Texas, where she lives with her partner and newborn son. Liz, welcome to the Artist Mother Podcast. Hi.
Thank you so much. That was so kind of an introduction.
I always like have this anxiety reading through the bio. It's so funny because, you know, it doesn't faze me to like be in conversation with somebody, but when I have to read something,
yeah,
without, I don't know, like I'm like, ugh. And you know, artist bios are always just these names on top of names on top of names on top of names. Like,
yeah, no, I get it.
Liz, I'm so excited to have you here and have you talk just about all of the amazing work that you're doing, the projects. And I
yeah,
just
thank
feel
you
like,
so much.
Yeah, I can't wait for this conversation. Let's dive in and, you know, help our audience get to know you a little bit better by, bringing us back to childhood. And, you know, is there a specific memory or a specific person or something that really influenced sort of your path to being an artist today?
Yeah. So I grew up in a small town outside of Houston called Humble, okay. Humble, Texas, in Texas. And one thing that we did every year was go to the rodeo. That was a big to-do.
Okay.
And I love animals. I'm vegan. I love animals. But back then, I really loved to go to the rodeo for two reasons. One, because I got to see pig races, which they raced for Oreos, which was amazing.
What?
And two,
like
yeah,
the pigs
they raced for
eight Oreos.
Oh yeah, they're like baby pigs, and they have a racetrack. This like campy racetrack, and they race for Oreos. And we had pom poms. It was a whole thing. And the second reason is because I always got a new pair of cowboy boots,
nice.
Like every couple years, I guess. And so there's one pair of boots that I made my parents rebuy in multiple sizes because I loved them so much. But they were pink and they had sequins and they had hot pink fringe off the back,
like
blowing off the back of them. And I wore the crap out of them. I just loved them so much. And so there's this funny memory in my head of wearing these cowboy boots and just, I mean, that's still definitely, I use fringe in a lot of my work. So it's funny to think about it as a material, but also just like the campiness of wearing these hot pink fringe cowboy boots. I feel like that's a very good summary of my personality.
Yes, I love that. And like the sort of range of like this very masculine like thing that people are doing, riding bulls and, you know, lassoing large sweaty animals. Yeah. And then, you know, you were like the most attractive to the hot pink sequined fringed boots, you know, yes. just like, yes. I love that sort of kind of juxtaposition, like setting up this conversation and talking about your work. That's perfect. Yeah. So my parents lived in Wyoming for 4 years when they first got married. And so the Cheyenne Frontier Days was like a big thing that they went to every year. And when I was 16, we did a road trip out west and went to that rodeo. And we actually went to like PBR. That stuff is crazy. Like,
yeah,
it's awesome. Like I grew up like an athlete. So like, I love the thrill of like an athletic event and like people yeah. coming around and like, you know, kind of rooting for somebody, but man, cowboy stuff is
hardcore. Intense.
Cow people.
Yeah, it is intense. And I was really blissfully unaware of, you know, the kind of selling of the, and like the route, the, you know, I was more interested in the show aspects.
Than right.
The
kind right. Of. I love that. And the Oreos.
And the Oreos, yes. And my grandpa used to bring Oreos with us so we could eat Oreos.
While the pigs, you were like, we don't even have to work for this.
Exactly.
Okay, so speaking of, I feel like that's a great segue to have you talk just a little bit about the specific art that you make. You can talk about your materials and your processes. I know your work is pretty diverse in terms of like range and concept. But if you could just give us an idea, like especially for listeners who, you know, prior to hearing the podcast may not have a visual of like what your work looks like. Can you give us kind of some background to that?
Yeah. So I identify as an interdisciplinary artist and I work across video, sound, glass, sculpture, and performance. That's the majority of my mediums.
Okay.
And in my practice with all my projects, I'm questioning three main questions. So the first is, what is the future of feminism, which you mentioned already? Mm-hmm. The second is, what are the politics of visibility, of being a visible bodied person? Mm-hmm. And the third is, how are archives site for re-envisioning? So how can archives serve our practice and serve our communities in ways that are engaging and re-envisioning and radical instead of just looking at the past? Mm-hmm. I also, I utilize technology in a lot of my projects, and I think about technology as a poetic tool. So it's not just, I'm not a submissive user. I really want to understand how to use the technology and integrate it into my practice as well. But this has taken some really weird turns. So, yeah. You know, I've worked with Jell-O and gelatin and making blown glass as Jell-O. I work with glass a lot. My mom is actually still a practicing stained glass artist in Houston.
Oh, cool.
So yeah. So I grew up in her studio around women making glass, mm-hmm. these huge stained glass panels, which was really fundamental to my ideas of what an artist could look like.
Yeah.
So I think, that I like to summarize it in saying my practice is kind of at gender, technology, and identity in that spectrum.
Do you have somewhat of a visual language that you would associate with your work?
I do. I mean,
I know that's kind of a painterly question to ask, but
yeah, it's interesting because the visual language, that is something that I've been trying to kind of outline and define for myself since my work is so project oriented and really develops out of research. So I will research something for a really long time before I even start a project. And so the visual language and the commonality that I see in my work is really around an aesthetic, a digital aesthetic or a physical aesthetic that are comparable, whether that's colors or tonality, right. in sound or digital space. That's something that I'm still developing. Mm-hmm. That's definitely difficult to translate into my practice.
Yeah, definitely. Why don't you tell me about a couple specific pieces? Like, I would love to hear more specifically about kind of, well, either you could relate it to those three questions that you shared. Like I guess this is a multi-question question, but like, I would love to know a little bit more about how you arrived at like those three questions sort of being what you're investigating. And then maybe you could talk about that by describing a few of, you know, your larger works.
Yeah. So in 2018, I had a residency at the Museum of Glass in Tacoma. Mm-hmm. And for that residency, I think about this body of work really because it kind of hits all three of these points. Mm-hmm. So thinking about the future of feminism, the politics of visibility, and also re-envisioning archives. So that I created a body of work while I was in residence. I created 22 blown glass fruits that are clear fruits that were scaled to my body. Okay. So like as I was on the floor at the Museum of Glass, we were using these like really awesome vintage calipers and measuring different parts like my breasts and my fists.
Oh, cool.
And then we would eat fruit like as a team and study it. And then right. We would blow these glass, clear glass fruits, and all of them have a hole, like an orifice. So when they're exhibited, they're filled with colored gelatin. So bright, hot pink colored gelatin. Okay. So they become this embodiment. I really love glass as a material because it's in flux. Mm-hmm. It can be a liquid and it can be a solid and it can go back to a liquid form, right? So it's this really fluid material that's really strong, but also really vulnerable. And for that body of work, for the fruit machine, Tutti Frutti, whatever you want to call it, I was really interested in this document that I came across in a text that I was reading that I found out the Canadian and the United States governments in the 1950s and 60s, following the Cold War, were developing this technology that they called the fruit machine. And it was actually called the fruit machine. And it was a series of tests and technologies that they could use to basically find queer people in the military and kick them out. So it was like a sweat test and a
Michael Scott's gaydar.
Kind of, yeah.
Right? But isn't that what he called it? Didn't he have like a wand?
I think he did, yeah.
And it most like buzzed when it was on him or something.
Exactly. yeah, but it was, I mean, the funny thing is it was just, it's very barbaric. It was a very barbaric, militaristic, you know, use of technology. And all of the technology that they created for this fruit machine was destroyed. So none of it actually exists anymore. Except there's one document that I got my hands on that's an uncensored document that kind of outlined how they did what they did. And so I was thinking of the residency as a way to like physically make a fruit machine, calling myself a fruit and embodying the fruit and thinking about all the semiotics, the language around fruit in this playful way instead of a derogatory way. So using the archival material, using this declassified document, so ridiculous, and then kind of remixing it, putting it back into the practice, thinking about visibility, thinking about my own body as a feminist, and then accompanying that is a single channel video artwork called Boy with a Fruit Basket. And it is a video of my partner eating an entire huge mountain of fruit while gazing at the camera directly. And then accompanying that video is a soprano singing some of the language from the censored documents. So there becomes this play between being looked at and looking at, right, the observer or the observed, and kind of putting the gaze back out.
Amazing. Where was this work exhibited?
Yeah, so it was exhibited, first at the Museum of Glass, and then I had a solo exhibition in Dallas at Gallery Urbane, Marfa, Dallas. And then it went back to Tacoma, Puget Sound.
Okay.
And I had a smaller exhibition of it again in Austin. It's kind of traveled, as I've exhibited it, I've kind of made it into smaller sub-series. So I'll show like the strawberries and the blueberries or a smoothie version of the work.
Yeah. I love that. I would love to experience that work. Tell me a little bit more about some of the other like mediums that you work with. You've talked about glass and video and how that kind of, you know, was present in that body of work. I just, as a multimedia artist, like, I'm just interested, like, to know a little bit more about how you kind of decide on, you know, like, you have this idea and concept and you're making these experiments, but then there must be a lot of shuffling in terms of like, well, I could use cement or I could do it in this way, or this could be performance. Like, I'm just kind of interested to have you talk a little bit about that journey specifically with the decision making and maybe like what challenges sort of come up for you within that like stage of creation.
Yeah. So if I drew a Venn diagram of my practice, I would have a circle on the left of glass and I would have a circle on the right of video. And then in the middle, there would be all of these amazing things like fringe and performance and the body and sound and all these other kind of outlets. But really, the glass and the video art really ground my practice in interesting ways, I think, digitally and physically. But in terms of thinking about what medium to use or how to develop projects, you know, as I mentioned, everything is really research-based. So I'll have an idea to research something and it comes out of a curiosity, just like wanting to know more. And then I'll kind of obsessively research it and then have some preliminary ideas of what I think it should look like or what it could, how it could be envisioned or developed or what tools I might want to use. Sometimes things also develop out of a desire to really want to use something new. Or experiment with something that I haven't experimented before. And I don't feel like bound in any kind of, I'm really open. Okay. I'm open to collaborations. I'm open to happy accidents. I'm open to just moving in the world in that way. And I think that really embodies how I make my work. It's just being open to failure, being open to accidents, being open to, you know, kind of whatever I feel moved to do based on the research, and then finding the right people to play with me, right? Like that's so important. I'm not formally trained as a glass artist, so I have a lot of knowledge about glass, whether it's neon or blown glass, but by no means did I go to school or was I trained on the craft.
Okay. I was curious about that, if you like went to school for it or what.
Yeah, I keep joking I'm going to go back and get another MFA in glass. My wife is like, no. but yeah, so I think it's just curiosity. Honestly, it's like just a generous dose of curiosity and being open to the path that I go towards, whatever that is and whatever changes or happen. Like, I don't feel like I'm indebted or like I have to make something a certain way. It's just really kind of in the moment, being present, being inspired and adapting to, you know, whatever crap gets thrown at you while you're in the process of making something.
Yeah. I think that's such a great perspective too, because, you know, that experimentation, that like sort of leading with the openness, you know, really pushes up against the commodification of the art world and sort of the capitalization that tends to happen, right? Like, because you're, and I know like we're all within this structure, and I'm sure that's part of the challenges you face is like, you know, some of those things, but I'm inspired by hearing you talk about your practice, 'cause I feel like it pushes against a lot of those, you know, cultural things that get in the way of artists really making the most sincere work that they can make, you know?
Yeah. And I've been really researching Krita Kent's work, this radical nun from the 60s who's a printmaker.
Okay.
And I'm so inspired by the way that she also embodies joy, the sense of joy. I am always thinking about, where's the joy in this? Am I, like, not Marie Kondo style, like, does this spark joy? But like, from like a very deep level, am I putting something that I feel joyful about or that is joyful to others? You know, can it inspire joy? And so even in Karita Kent had this quote, seeking joy through difficult good, pursuing joy through difficult good. So even if something is difficult, we can still find joyful aspects of the work, right? Mm-hmm. So I really think about that a lot when I'm making anything.
Okay. And talk to me about how that connects with this major question, you know, this major life question, this major art question that you're exploring. What is the future of feminism? Like, what does that question mean to you? And why is that sort of this banner that you're kind of, you know, staking a lot of your life underneath?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really huge, huge conversation.
Yeah.
I do think, so future feminist discourse, I really frame it in a middle ground between what bell hooks calls feminism for everybody, quote unquote, and what queer theorist Jose Esteban Munoz describes as a horizon imbued with potentiality. So there's a middle space between being for everybody and fulfilling potential that is a horizon and hasn't happened yet. And those two theories that are existing in different ethos, I really see myself in the middle of that in everything that I do with my practice. And so I think, you know, feminism gets a really bad rap because of multiple reasons, but especially because it's always been tied to the binary, the idea of the binary, right? Of the binary gender.
Right.
And so I think for me, future feminism, it's inclusive. It's intergenerational. It leads environmental justice initiatives. It follows Black, Latinx, Native American, queer, all the kind of minorities. And it comes from this place of pursuing bodily autonomy. It also is based in the politics of belonging. So having a space and just centering the lives of the most vulnerable among us, for me. So that's really, when I think about the future of feminism, I say it as a hopeful tone because, like Jose Munoz mentioned, we're not there yet. It's something that can exist. It's in our power. And I think that belonging, that feeling of wanting to dismantle systems of oppression is really, you know, the work that we all need to be doing with each other.
Amazing. So,
you know, and I think a lot of people, you know, as a queer person and as a parent now and all these things, it's people get really uncomfortable when you start thinking about intersectionality and practice, right? So, I really think it's also recognizing non-monetary forms of labor, which I think is another part of this, right?
Right. Yeah. I mean, of course, the word that kept coming up for me was care, right? Like how is labor and care associated with these conversations, and who are we valuing and what are we commodifying, and, you know, what is free labor and how does that
And what does it matter if, we don't have a world?
Right. Yep.
I mean, I feel so paralyzed right now based on seeing the news. I've been really, you know, with all of the war that's happening right now, and the way that the New York Times has been covering maternity and motherhood.
I know.
I have no words. I feel very, I feel paralyzed. I mean, just seeing and hearing and reading, and I can't think of any other war where motherhood has been covered in a similar way.
It's really interesting that you say that, because it does feel like everything I read about who is getting hardest hit in Ukraine, it's newborns. I just this morning, you know, I was having coffee over at my parents, and we don't have cable, but the big, you know, they're watching the Today Show, and it was like another maternity hospital hit. And, you know, they're showing these images of like full term women coming out on stretchers.
It's really like, I mean, I just thinking about care, it's, it's like that, right? I mean, we're living it right now.
So much.
I don't have answers, but it's more of a proposition. When I think about the future of feminism, it's a proposition of do better and really care, you know?
Liz, you're amazing.
Oh, you're so kind.
Tell me more about who you are sort of outside of your art career. I feel like we've, you know, spent a good time talking about your work, and we're going to lead into talking about the Queer Birth Project. But I would like to know just personally a little bit more about your life. Like, you live in Texas, maybe talk about your family a little bit.
Who am I? That's a big question. So I am a professor. I'm associate professor of new media at the University of North Texas. I'm also vegan. I love to read. I love to roller skate.
Love it. Which, where is the University of North Texas?
It's in Denton, which is a small town by
Dallas. I know where Denton is because I know Cassie Arnold, an artist.
So it's equidistant between Dallas and Fort Worth. And it's referred to as the Austin of the 70s.
Okay.
So it's like pre-industrialization of Austin.
Okay. Interesting.
It's a pretty funky little space. You know, it's a large state university. So we have like 36,000 students.
Wow.
I mean, I've been really lucky. We have a brand new art building. And so it's growing a lot. Yeah.
Awesome.
So that's kind of my life, my job. And, I'm an artist and my life feels like it's in flux right now. Cause I'm also a brand new parent. So I have this huge, transformation. My wife and I, just had a child December 19th.
So congratulations.
Thank you. He's just a joy and a love bug, and he's a sleeper. So we're really happy about that.
Awesome.
So I feel like I'm constantly just trying to carve out 15 minutes to do things right now, but I wouldn't change it for anything.
Yeah. So tell me a little bit more about the Queer Birth Project and sort of how that came about, like in conjunction with your process of becoming a parent.
Yeah. So the Queer Birth Project is we're imagining it as a 5-year arts-based research project. And I'm doing it collaboratively with a queer sociologist and queer parent. And the goal of the project is to share and document childbirth experiences of queer people in America. So including all of the LGBTQ plus community. Mm-hmm. And the structure of this project is based on a revisiting of Judy Chicago's birth project, which she did between 1981 and 1985. And in 1981, Judy Chicago posed the question, how do women feel about all aspects of birth? So to answer that question, she published a survey that people could answer. She did interviews. And then she collaborated with hundreds of needle workers all over the country to create her giant textile works that became some of the only representations of births for a really long time. And still to this day, they're, you know, I love them. So they're really challenging to think about, but I love them as a proposition. And so 40 years after she did that work, we are asking, how do queer people feel about all aspects of birth? Understanding that queer families are building families in really diverse ways, and that, access to things like healthcare and just representation and visibility is really important. So that project also kind of developed out of my own desire for seeking community in our own parental path. After years of loss and challenging reproductive health care and finally having a viable pregnancy and kind of coming full circle and thinking about how to form community and reflect on queer birth.
Will you tell me a little bit more about your journey becoming a parent?
So My journey is not rose-colored, nor is it conventional, but it's nonetheless pretty magical. Mm-hmm. So my partner and I have been together for 15 years.
Okay.
And in 2018, we decided to start trying to have a child.
Okay.
And I always wanted to carry a child, so I was going to be the gestational parent. We have an amazing known donor who we were really excited. He said yes and mm-hmm. was willing to, you know, be a donor. And having a known donor was important to us because we really see it as an extension of our family, and having that space for our children to build whatever relationship they want with him.
Right.
Just keeping that open and honest.
Mm-hmm.
And so in 2018, we started going through all the processes of trying to have a baby, which mm-hmm. in Texas with a known donor is super complicated. So we, you know, he was donating to a sperm bank. We were waiting 6 months. We were doing all the tests. We have to go through a fertility clinic because if there's all these weird laws in Texas. So anyway, 2 years later, I had 9 IUIs, multiple miscarriages. Brittany and I were about to switch to reciprocal IVF. I was going to carry her eggs.
Okay.
When I had a pap smear and they found a large tumor on my thyroid.
Oh my gosh.
So it was an urgent thing because it was pushing on my carotid artery. At the time it was like a baseball sized tumor.
Oh huge. My gosh.
Yeah. So everything got put on hold and I had a kind of emergency surgery, and then thank God it wasn't cancerous. Mm-hmm. But in the surgery, there was a complication. So they nicked my right laryngeal nerve, leaving me vocally paralyzed. So I can talk right now because I had another procedure that temporarily gives me the ability to speak, but my right vocal cord is permanently paralyzed from it. So,
oh my gosh. What do you mean by temporarily?
Yeah, so they will do an injection where they can fill your vocal cords when they come together in the middle. One of my vocal cords no longer comes up. It can't come up. So
okay. They
can fatten it up with like a filler.
So you have to get that periodically filled?
Yeah, yeah. Like every 6 months or so. Yeah, so it's not fun. Yeah. But at least I have a voice now and went through speech therapy and all that fun stuff. But so that happened. And as I was recovering from that surgery, my wife, who is more non-binary, masculine of center, mm-hmm. never wanted to carry a pregnancy, you know, but watched me struggle for 2.5 years of mm-hmm. miscarrying. And now this was right. like, you know, why don't you just let me try?
Mm-hmm.
Like, why don't I just try for us?
Mm.
Which in itself was a complete reversal of our roles, right?
Yeah.
And really difficult for both of us to process. But the funny thing is we had run out of sperm at that point.
Okay.
So we were like, okay. And it was COVID. So we were like, the clinic's closed anyway. So we were like, we're just going to do this at home. We're going to get, you know, a 99-cent syringe and specimen cups from Amazon. And
turkey baster.
Yes. Our donor is local. And so he came over, he gave us a sample, and Brittany got pregnant the first time.
What? That really works? Like that's like the TV version.
Oh yeah. So she, you know, it was like
literally
a 99-cent syringe after spending like $15,000 and 2.5 years of heartache.
People, she gets pregnant. Try the syringe first.
Yeah. So she got pregnant.
Legs up, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's really interesting to think about. I mean, the whole reproductive healthcare system forcing us to use frozen sperm. And in general, like there are things that are already against us, right? So thank God for
what a story, Liz. I mean, that
amazing
just
donor.
Made me tear up too, just with your, you know, with Brittany. Like just deciding, like, I'm just going to try this and I'm going to do it. And, you know, just the trust that you both must have with each other. And I can't imagine like the way that has influenced your relationship.
Yeah. I mean, it was intense for a really long, like, thank God for therapy. I will mm-hmm. say that.
Yeah.
But you know, it's really brought us closer together and challenged both of us in really unique ways that we never thought we would be challenged, especially as parents going into parenthood. And then,
well, and even your own understanding of, you know, like you kind of preface that with like, Brittany is more like masculine identifying. Oh, yeah. And just, I just think it's so interesting, like, even within the structure of your own understanding of fluidity and gender, having those things like move across that spectrum in different ways, like, is just really powerful.
Yeah. I mean, it's been, and I will say the birth was just like, I was there. I caught him and I, you know, he came out eyes open, staring at me, and like, I'm going to cry just thinking about it.
Yeah, but I'm going to cry.
It was a really beautiful full circle. Like, she is a fucking badass and like did this thing for us. And now we have this beautiful child. Thank God. But yeah, I think, and not even just the birth and the pregnancy, but breastfeeding, chest feeding, feeding from her body has also been a really challenging, like, I'm like, I wish I could help you do this.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, thinking about gender and the kind of flexibility within our relationship dynamic and our own identities. And now as parents, it's been a really slippery slide.
Yeah. Is it really happening? Are we finally able to do this? Friends, we are thrilled to share that we are hosting our second in-person retreat, woo, in the mountains of North Carolina this May. Come join us Friday evening, May 27th through Monday morning, May 30th. That's Memorial Day weekend 2022. The weekend will be a well-balanced mix of workshops, artist talks, hiking, rest, great food, and you guessed it, incredible conversation. I can't wait to sit around a fire on a rocking chair and just enjoy getting to know all of you. We are going to hear from some incredible presenters. Actually, I almost can't believe that I got these crazy awesome folks to agree to come and share with us. Coulter Fussell will be there, Isadora Stowe, Barbara Campbell Thomas, Chloe Alexander, Amanda Brazier, and Sarah Sidhoff will all be offering something dynamic and inspiring to those of us who are coming. This retreat is really for you. It is about us, about coming together, networking, sharing our interests and our joy as a community, but it's also just about you. I know how much it means for artists like you to take this time for yourselves. It is so important and so necessary. And we really believe in doing this work of providing an opportunity for you to connect with others and restore yourself. By the way, you don't have to be an artist mother to join us. We've already got several badass female artists who aren't mamas who are coming, and we just can't wait to meet you. So come join me and my incredible band of retreaters in the mountains in May. Full retreat details are available on our website, including the list and descriptions of all workshops we'll be doing, information on the retreat locations and accommodations, as well as information about our scholarship opportunities and funding. Go to artistmotherpodcast.com/retreat to find it all, and please email me with any questions that you have at artistmotherpodcast@gmail.com. Join us in the mountains. Can't wait to see you there. I would love to know, kind of, you know, now that your son is here, like, what, and I know he's only several months old, so this is a question that I'm sure you're gonna be exploring, you know, the rest of your life, really, but just thinking about, like, how, you know, some of your perspectives have changed even as you were already, you know, exploring this idea of, you know, queer birth and like queer narratives within the maternal narrative. Yeah, just like wanting to know, you know, what are some kind of some big like personal revelations that have happened in the past couple months now that you're like tangibly, we have a child and yeah. I have crossed over from, you know, this experience of wanting a child and working for a child to now I actually have one. And what has that kind of done for your perception?
Yeah. I mean, I definitely, it's interesting because I feel like in my mind, I can separate the pregnancy from like now having a child. Mm-hmm. They feel like two different things to me. Mm-hmm. And honestly, I've become much more aware of the ways that I'm absent, right? So I couldn't physically experience the birth. I couldn't physically experience chest feeding. Mm-hmm. And so it's made me more aware of my own presence and mm-hmm. my own relation to my partner and to him mm-hmm. In interesting ways that are manifesting in new work for me. Mm-hmm. But honestly, I really thought for a while that it wasn't going to happen, you know, that I was just going to have to give up mm-hmm. and then I was not going to have a voice on top of that. So it was like mm-hmm. a really low point.
Yeah. I can't imagine.
And so that the fact, like, I feel like we're just amazed every day. We just look at him and we're like, you're actually here. You actually exist.
What did you name him?
His name is LB Nelson.
Mm-hmm. That's so sweet.
Yeah. We named him LB after Britt's great-grandfather and Nelson after my father, who passed away shortly before we started trying to get pregnant. But yeah, I think it's really interesting because being queer and pursuing pregnancy and parenthood in this way has forced us to completely rethink our roles and completely rethink this idea of a nuclear family and completely rethink our, you know, it's really like, how can we make this 50-50 and how can we co-parent in the best possible way for this child?
Yeah.
And putting the focus on him and his existence and his thriving really has brought us together and helped us, you know, through all of these difficult changes and through these challenges. So I would say that's kind of the biggest way that it's changed our perspectives, my mm-hmm. perspective.
What are some of like the biggest things that you feel like you need, or like what support do you wish that you have? And maybe it's you have legs of this support, but it could be there more. Like, and you can talk. I mean, this is like a point of conversation, I feel like, for a lot of artist mothers, right? Because there's just this a major lack of support for artists. There's a major lack of support for mothers and those, you know, people raising children. But, you know, I think specifically too about, you know, what it's like to be a queer artist mother. Like, are there, you know, specific things that you feel like you could use a little more of?
Yeah. I mean, I think community is one of them, right? So the Queer Birth Project is an attempt to really feel connected. Mm-hmm. I sought out a queer community queer birth class community and a queer early parenting community. And thankfully I found this amazing support group online mm-hmm. Through Maya Fertility in Seattle. So it's all virtual thanks to COVID. Mm-hmm. But now I feel I have this amazing support group of early parents who all had kids around the same time and all queer people. Mm-hmm. So I have connections now to people in Seattle and New York and, you know, all over, and we're all kind of following each other's babies. And
yes,
it's really amazing. There's 12 families in that group. So
awesome.
That's kind of one thing that's helped. Mm-hmm. I will say we're struggling with space at the time right now. We're looking for a bigger house that I can build a studio. Cause I gave up my secondary studio space because mm-hmm. I can't go now with the baby. It was too much. So I gave it up and I'm just kind of working out of our house right now.
Okay.
But the goal would be to build a secondary structure at our house.
Okay.
So that's something that we're working towards, is just building more space mm-hmm. to have my studio practice, and be a working parent. And beyond that, I think just time. I mean, honestly, mm-hmm. I wish there was more, like, I wish that the queer community that I found virtually existed here in person and we could just pool our babies together and help each other. And, you know, not even just queer people, but just in terms of, you know, taking a village, quote unquote, to raise a child, just more arms, more people.
Absolutely. And it's such a weird time for that kind of, you know, community building because, well, you know, like we're so physically divided because of COVID and all this political discourse that, I mean, just pulls people apart. It's just so destructive.
So I think finding my own community, my own local community has been really, it's a challenge just because of where we are in COVID and but
and Texas and
in Texas,
although I mean, it's everywhere. It's not just Texas.
Yeah. But yeah, 12 hands. Can I get 12 hands? I
would
like 12 hands.
You know? I love that. Liz, just tell me a little bit more before we wrap up, like about some of your goals for the Queer Birth Project. Like what are some kind of big things you're hoping to do? And, you know, maybe just some dreams that you have for the project. This can be, you know, a matter of just speaking some things into existence that don't exist yet.
Yeah. So, over the next year, we're picking up the research for this project. So the survey is open right now. So anybody who wants to take the survey can go. We recreated Judy Chicago's survey with all-inclusive language, new questions, published it as a national survey. So that's step one. And that is available for anybody who identifies as queer and has experience with childbirth, gestational, non-gestational, surrogate, anyone can take it. So beyond collecting this survey, the goal is to create a series of visual art inspired by it in the same vein of Judy Chicago's process. So we're really looking at her process and recreating the process, but questioning the methods and questioning what we're changing or leaving out, right? So the National Survey collection of artworks for exhibition that would be neon and video. A publication, we're working on a publication as well for this project. And then the creation of a new archive. So going back to this idea of the future of feminism and archiving as a site of reckoning and radical possibilities, we're researching Judy Chicago's archive at the Schlesinger Library at Harvard, and then creating all of this new information, storytelling, narratives, artworks, documentation of artworks. And then, you know, the goal would be to kind of create a new archive that could live next to or in addition to hers. So it's a big project. And I would think if I was dreaming really, 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 really big, I would really love an exhibition of the works alongside the birth project, right?
Oh, absolutely. I wrote down an exhibition. I was like, we got to get you guys an exhibition.
Yeah. I mean, honestly, like, it would just be so rad to have the works physically exist in a space where they're in conversation with each other, right?
Yes. I literally was like, oh, this gallery would be great for that. I could see that, you know, just like, how can we, well, and even just your, you know, just the tangible experience of community, of seeing work in person, like.
Yeah. So right now I'm working, so the first iteration of artwork for this that I'm working on, and it includes a fringe. So I work with fringe a lot in my practice as well. Physical, like colorful fringe. So I'm working on this massive Calder mobile and style fringe that people can walk in and move around. And then neon that would accompany that is in response to one of our survey questions, which is what do you want your kids to call you, or how do you want them to call you other than, you know, mom or dad?
Okay.
So we have some really great names, you know, like Zaza, Baba, like all the names, you could go down the alphabet. And so I'm making that, crafting that language in neon. So how can I, you know, use these survey responses to make a new piece of visual art?
I love that. Amazing. Just one more question before we move to our final five. I want to just have you talk a little bit about the logistics, and this is a personal question because I know you are somebody who has your own art career. You have this large drive to build community. You've created a platform around it. you're a parent, how are you kind of keeping all those balls in the air? Like, how are you prioritizing certain things at the right times? How are you balancing building a platform and maintaining your own, you know, teaching and art career and parenting practice?
Yeah, I will say I'm the kind of person who likes to multitask.
Me too.
Like, I pull inspiration. I like to be having multiple fires, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's gotten challenging with new parenthood because I'm just really tired.
Right.
To be honest. But I hired a studio, my first studio manager, studio assistant. So I delegate now, which is really helpful. You know, I have a huge installation in Houston at the Botanic Gardens called Mother. And it's a 400-foot neon installation at the gardens. It's this amazing space if you're ever in Houston.
I have been there. Isn't there a huge butterfly garden there?
Yeah, there is. Yeah,
it's an amazing space.
Amazing.
It's been years since I was there, but I mean, I took so many pictures in there of my kids and stuff. It was beautiful.
It's so beautiful. But yeah, so with all our recent freak weather here, there's been a lot of glass breaking, right? So glass breaking always happens, but that's a lot to manage just in terms of getting it repaired. And so I hired an assistant, I delegate, I kind of prioritize a task for a day. So I'll say like, okay, my brain is going to think about this project today plus grading or like, you know, I try really hard to, you know, when I was grieving my father, I went to therapy really a lot for that. Mm-hmm. And I learned the kind of 3 things a day rule. So making a list of 3 things that are like your goal things that you want to do or think about in that day. And then anything after that is extra sauce, right?
Right.
But that's really stuck with me. So like, what are my 3 goals? Where do I want my head to be at today?
Right.
And goals insinuates outcome. They don't have to have outcomes, but just like 3 things that I want to focus on today.
I love
that. So that's how I structure it.
I love that. Thank you, Liz, for sharing. I feel like we're just scratching the surface. We might have to, you know, have another conversation sometime, but thank you so much. It's just been
so great.
Yeah, of course.
Thank you. Thank you for having this community that exists. It's just amazing what you're doing.
Well, I mean, just like you, tangible need, like, you know, just I needed this to exist. And, you know, I don't know. I just put the small resources that I had out there into the world to try to start it happening. And, you know, I think there's just something so powerful about trying to create something in the world that is authentically connected to a need that you specifically have, right? Because you don't feel seen, or you don't feel supported, or you don't feel, you know, how can you like turn that energy into tangible visibility for somebody else? Right.
Right.
You know?
Exactly.
Yeah. Like that's just like been one of the biggest sort of things I've learned, because there's probably somebody else out there who's feeling it too.
Absolutely.
Okay. Final 5. You ready?
Yes, I am so ready.
Who's your biggest art crush?
Okay, right now it is Clarity Haynes.
Clarity Haynes.
She is amazing and working on this series of birth images she's queer, she's fabulous. Total art crush.
Awesome. I was going to ask too, is Brittany, your partner, an artist?
She's a musician. So she's a classical flutist. She performs flute.
Amazing. Yeah. I love that. Okay. What is your favorite place to travel or a dream trip that you'd like to go on?
I am dying to go to Berlin. I've never been. I really want to go to Berlin.
I love that. Tell me about a film or a book that has been a big inspiration to you.
I would say Glitch Feminism by Legacy Russell. I own multiple copies of her book and I hand it out to my students all the time like candy. Mm-hmm. So if you haven't read it, it's a really easy read, and it's just anything Legacy writes is killer. So
perfect. Favorite meal?
Anything Tex-Mex.
Come on.
Tacos, fajitas, breakfast tacos, you know, some good salsa, like garlicky salsa. Oh, yes.
Love it. Well, at least you're in a good place for getting that food.
Yeah. I missed it when I was in Boston for sure.
Okay. And who would you like to give a shout out to someone who supports you in your work?
Yeah. So I would like to shout out to my wife, Brittany Balcom. She's, you know, she's everything to me, my whole world. And also my gallerist, Ree Williford from Gallery Urbane. She always embraces my eccentric ideas and larger than life. You know, she's just there with me side by side. So
great. I'm so glad you have that support. And finally, just tell everyone where your kind of handles are, your platforms, so they can find out more and follow all the projects that you're doing.
Yeah. So my website, just my name, listlafleur.com. And then my Instagram is also at listlafleur. And then the Queer Birth Project is at the Queer Birth Project on Instagram as well.
Perfect. Liz, please keep doing the work you're doing.
Thank you. Keep doing the work you're doing as well.
Okay, let's make a deal. We'll virtually handshake. We're going to keep this up.
Yes.
Thank you so much for coming on and sharing your story.
Yeah, thank you.
The Artist Mother Podcast is curated and produced by Kaylin Butine. Music by Josh Middleton. Editing and mixing by John M. Butine. Please visit www.artistmotherpodcast.com for episode notes and to find out how you can further support this podcast.